Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
There's this concept in somatic work that we use called glimmers. And it's this idea of like finding the moments of lightness and ease. And I think that's really important in a time like this. Yeah, the deep, dark stuff very much exists. And we're going to live in it. We're going to go through it and everything. But we also have to find moments of lightness and ease to give our nervous systems a different experience to remind us that we're here in the present moment and helps us move on to the next moment. Welcome to Holy Ghosting, a podcast about life after religion. I'm Meg.
I'm Sarai.
And today we are so happy to welcome back to the show Dr. Laura Anderson. Welcome back to Holy Ghosting.
Hello. It's so good to be here. I'm excited for what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, me too. If you have not heard our other conversations with Laura, please go check those out. And if you've never had the pleasure of meeting Laura, she is one of our favorites online. Anywhere on the internet that you like to go, Laura is there. And she is handing out free healing wisdom. She is a licensed psychotherapist and a trauma resolution coach. She is a speaker and an author and educator. And her influence within this community of people who are finding their ways out of high control religion, she really gives moments to just have some relief, to find some calm within some of that trauma and to really be centered and just remind us like what we are here for, that we actually do get to live beautiful lives and that we get to exist in whatever way we want to exist without strings attached. And we're so happy to have you here today, Laura, and we know that you're going to provide some really helpful advice for us and the listeners today around your religious trauma and the elections course. It is an amazing thing that you have created. People can get it any time before or after this election cycle. And for people who haven't heard about it, what is it that they're going to get when they come and get this course from you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. That was very kind words. It's great to be a part of this space and this podcast. Meeting with you guys is one of the most fun times. You know, I love doing the podcast episodes with you. So this is great. But yeah, I have this religious trauma in the elections course, and it's really designed to support people through the election cycle, before, during, after, everything like that. We're not telling you how to vote, who to vote for, you know, where you're supposed to land on legislation and policies, though there are certain speakers where you will definitely hear that bent. And we also don't shy away from the fact that there are certain political parties that lean towards certain things. And so when we're talking about things like Christian nationalism, we can't get away from the fact that that is, you know, being kind of overwhelmed by the Republican Party, right? So it's been this awesome course where every month we have two different modules that we drop. The first one is a lecture or conversation with some sort of a professional in the field, whether that's a podcaster, a professor, a therapist, a coach, talking about a specific topic. And then the second module in that month is them bringing to us tools, skills, interventions that we can be learning and using and implementing in your life immediately. So it's like,
we love that. You know,
yeah. Like
that's
group
your golden
almost.
Gift.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, every month you're going to get a ton of handouts with all of the different interventions on them, resources with books, websites, journaling prompts, and then of course the actual information that you're getting. And so we're talking about everything from learning to trust yourself, how to have embodied boundaries, how to navigate, you know, relationships with friends and family who are believing or voting differently with you, how to handle tough conversations. And the module that we have coming up post the elections is on grief. And what do we do now that it's all over, regardless of which candidate wins? you know, we know that things won't be the same. And the things that have come out during this election cycle have caused us all to be in a lot of crisis and survival and stress and having to deal with that and kind of the heaviness of it. I think once the election is over, it's like that starts to set in a little bit. And so, so I wanted to make sure that we kept the course going through the end of the year to make sure that we are covering for that as well. So I hope that people have felt resourced and encouraged by it. There's been some incredible conversations that we've been able to have around a variety of different topics. And I've really enjoyed participating in it as well.
That's amazing. If you haven't been able to check out Laura's course, Religious Trauma in the Elections, yet, maybe today will be a bit of a preview of it, because we're going to get into it a little bit. And I want to start with one of Sarai's favorite topics.
Yeah, the history of religion and politics.
I think it's important to note that a lot of people who have deconstructed or have started deconstructing, one of the trigger points for that can be political. And I, you know, always tell the story of my professor who, when I was in college, asked the question, actually answered the question, who are you going to vote for? With, I don't tell people who I'm going to vote for, but I will say my wife's a Republican, but I'm a Christian. And I remember literally losing my mind because I had no idea what he meant. And then he had to repeat it and explain it to me, like what he meant. And that then got me on track to go and look for myself. You know, what does Jesus say about how we should treat people who are poor? You know, how do we treat people who are marginalized by society? What should we be doing? What is our responsibility in that? And oopsies, I accidentally became a little bit of a liberal at my conservative Christian college. And that then made the fit for me with evangelical Christianity really uncomfortable because it is so enmeshed with, and my experience at least in the evangelical world, with the right wing and the uber conservative kind of Republican side of things. Not to villainize like one political party, but I will say that the on purpose kind of overtaking of the religious right has been very methodical. And we lived in really the epicenter of that starting to come to fruition. And over the last 45 years, we have seen all these institutions fall apart. We, as people who were babies and young people, as those supports, social supports were starting to be torn down, don't even know really what it was like before and or what it could be like now. And so that's, yeah, you know, I talk about it because I think it's really important for us to be consistent in values. And for me, when I was still a Christian and professing to follow Jesus, it was really uncomfortable to say that while also being like, well, gay people shouldn't exist. Like this was in the early 2000s, late 90s, when, you know, it was that God, guns and gays were like the thing that we talked about in political arenas. So I'm curious, yeah, what are some of the things that you touch on with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first place that we start, because I think it's something that lays the foundation for why are we even doing this course, right? Why did we get here? Why is everybody so stressed out? Why does it feel like we can't escape, you know, this rhetoric that we thought we were escaping when we were leaving churches and deconstructing and deconverting? And so I think that it's important to focus on that because, like you were saying, there's so much intertwined that so many of us grew up with that didn't even know it. And to be fair, I think when all of us grew up, it was not as overt as it is now. You know, there was I remember my pastor talking about, you know, voting for biblical values and things like that, but they were very careful not to say this is the candidate necessarily until, of course, James Dobson came around and was like, you know, here's all that stuff. But that, yeah, that's, you know, probably in the 90s, early 2000s. But I think that there's a lot of people that don't understand how we got here. I remember earlier this year, I was listening to a podcast of some friends of mine that came out of a cult, but it was not connected to religion at all. And they hadn't grown up religious. And they were speaking to somebody who has a history in, you know, this sort of thing. And the one of the co-hosts says, you know, like, is this something we even need to worry about? Like, this is the first time I'm hearing about it. And it was kind of this like reality check for me, because I think that for a lot of people, this actually is the first time they're hearing about it.
Yep.
So they hear about Project 2025 and they're like, no way would anybody ever get on board with that. And there's this huge, you know, mass of people that are like, yeah, we came out of that and mm-hmm. we've been able to see the long game and how we got to the point that we have a 900-page document that even exists. Mm-hmm. And so there is a large portion of the population that was never involved with this growing up and really don't take that seriously, because why would they?
Because it seems completely outlandish, right? Like
of course it does. Yeah.
The emergence of this like white Christian nationalism, the overt white supremacy, the overt like full from the campaign stage, the debate even talking about refugees in horrible ways. And honestly, it just really plays into white Christian fears. And of course, we have the apocalypse to handle and the, you know, great war in Israel that all of these people are cheering on. It seems bizarre to people who aren't from that world, because it is bizarre. Like, it doesn't seem like it could be real. And yet here we are with it becoming more and more mainstream. And these folks have been empowered and indoctrinated to believe these things. And in fact, a lot of these churches that are involved, I'll say like Bethel and some others that are very clearly like the Seven Domains shit. For lack of a more correct legal term, Seven Domains shit have been overtly doing this work as well. And so the people who are following this are following it with not only a political bent, but a religious fervor, where they literally believe that God has told them to set their children apart and train them up to be a militia, essentially, to fight for what they call the kingdom of God, which of course isn't really the kingdom of God. Spoiler alert. Sorry, guys. You're wrong. Oops.
And, you know, I think that a lot of people, too, who have not grown up in this don't understand the long game that has been played. You know, they don't understand like, oh, hey, you know, when Billy Graham is rising to fame and popularity back in the late 50s and early 60s, fighting against godless communism. And how do we, bring the nation back to God? I think we can make a case that it even started way before then, but that's where we're really seeing some of these overt themes of Christian nationalism start to take place. And was it the 1960 something election, Barry Goldwater and Lyndon Johnson? And we're starting to see a lot of this coming from Orange County, California, and across, you know, the Sun Belt.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people don't realize like this did not happen overnight. This has been going on for decades. And what the Christian nationalists have learned to do is to play the long game and to be patient and to understand how to take over various forms of media and education and portions of society to slowly chip away to now we can have this bombastic character who is not really actually about Christian nationalism. He's only about his own power, but he's the perfect figure to be the head of this because they gain power through him. And they have been waiting for somebody to be able to do this. And Trump just happened to be the right person at the right time, not because it's God's man, but because he was just bizarre enough that he would buy into the same rhetoric and the same power hunger that Christian nationalists are interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. And to see that they really, I think, were looking for a bully, you know, there's like, I can be the Christian and hold these values. But if he does it, like, it's for the same purpose. And I've heard a lot of people trying to compare him with, you know, God using horrible people in the Bible and just saying, you know, look at what happened. Roe was overturned. I mean, there's a lot of prayer requests that were heard when he was first elected. Going back to that long game, taking over the judiciary with extremely conservative judges has been a very purposeful thing. And, you know, we have think tanks that have been planning this forever. Heritage Foundation, who authored the Project 2025 report, really, they just said the quiet part out loud by producing that and publishing it.
Yeah.
But a lot of this stuff has already been out there, which, again, people who weren't in that world where evangelicalism and political activism were so closely married intentionally, it is really hard to fathom. And I also think that it's extremely damaging to people who, those of us who were raised with that. I find the enmeshment of the concept of God and what's right and God is on our side and meshing that with a political agenda that has literally nothing to do with that and is it really a lot spawned from industry hating the New Deal, which is actually one of the big things. That's why in the Eisenhower administration in the 50s, we started saying in God we trust on our money and added one nation under God to the Pledge of Allegiance. So some of this stuff was happening in the 50s and 60s, like you were saying, and then culminating a lot into the 80s.
I was also thinking back to just how enmeshed my Christian education was, because I was in private Christian education my whole life until high school, and how much that also paired with loving the troops, you know? Desert Storm was a big thing when I was a kid, and we had, I actually won a poster contest, just not to brag, you guys.
Nice.
But in elementary school at my Christian school.
Is that what's hanging like above your mantle?
Yes.
The poster.
That's what it is. She's held it in,
like
in the highest esteem
ever
since.
One of those yellow, you know, ribbons around. We had ribbons around everything. And I didn't realize that it was like the Christian school had ribbons around everything. The church had ribbons around everything. Like, it wasn't every single place you went, wasn't every home. But supporting the troops was a really big one. Also, the trust in the police was a massive pairing that I think that authoritative figurehead, you know, kind of going back to like Trump being this bully type. I think there was a lot to that with that Old Testament God, the God that would not take shit from anybody. He was going to protect children. That's only Jesus. God didn't do that in the Old Testament. He liked to murder kids a lot. That tracks, actually. Okay. We weren't talking about why Roe needed to be overturned. We all just knew it. We all just knew why. It was in our hearts, you know, since the time we were young enough to know, which was actually, I was too young to know any of that. I was too young to know about Revelation and the end times, which was all, again, for me, wrapped up in politics. There was a lot of conversations when we had the revelation. I guess he's like a traveling salesman about the end times, I guess. Is that who came to visit my church? Someone like that.
That's
where,
funny.
You know, he's just like promoting the end times.
The Lyle Landley of the end times,
right,
coming through to your tent revival near you.
And it was, but this all, again, was biblical, wrapped up with right now, what was happening in our world right now, the signs that we were seeing, the ways that it was like, we all know Jesus is coming back. And that was very coupled with politics and the politics of today. So even though I was very outside of this, the knowledge of what all of these operatives were working on, you know, for the last 40 years, those things were just a part of my normal, a part of what was embedded in being a Christian. I did not have any questions about whether or not I was going to sign up to be a Republican when I turned 18. It was like, of course. I mean, I voted in church buildings all the time in California. It's like, this is what we do. We vote Republican. We save the babies one day. If I had still been embedded in this controlling religion when Roe was overturned, I know what kind of party I would have been at. You know, and that's scary to me. It's scary to me, just if you're not released from some part of that control, whether it's your family and your parents or your partner who are still involved in a church or in that community, and you don't feel like you can get your way out. I think you can. I think we could talk about some of that right now, about having boundaries and embodying those boundaries and ways that we can protect ourselves. We know that this is coming. It's like a tsunami where you like see all the signs brewing and they warn you about it. And like we said at the beginning, we don't know what the outcome of this election will be, but it will have some tumultuous times. It just will. We know that because we're living in it right now.
Yeah.
What are ways that we can help to navigate that for ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think boundaries is a great way to talk about things. I always like embodied boundaries, you know, this idea of really tuning into yourself. But that requires more than just a list of here's what I can do, here's what I cannot do, or here's what somebody else should or should not do. It's the idea of like, I have to take care of myself. I have to find safety within myself. And what do I need to do so that I can feel safe? And sometimes that does mean like, I need to not spend time with certain people, or I need to not talk about certain things with certain people. Like, or if this is the conversation, we're heading down this road, I need to be able to rein it back in for myself and put a pause on it. But embodied boundaries so much are about, how am I going to take care of myself so that I'm feeling safe? And that's really important, because I think there's many, many people, probably more like this than not, that do have family members and friends that are still entrenched in those high control religions, within Christian nationalism. And it's very hard to learn how to navigate relationships, or to know if a relationship is even possible, because it has to look so different than maybe what other relationships look like. And so I think that's part of boundary work, is first going like, what am I actually okay with? What can I actually handle? What do I have capacity to handle? And that could be asking yourself questions like, would I be okay to spend time with this person? So long as we're not talking about these topics, you know, but maybe I can talk about sports with them, or that's something we have in common, or we could talk about, you know, the kids, that, or we could spend time going and doing something we'll go to an apple orchard where we're not having to get into discussion, but we're not going to sit across from the table and have coffee with one another. Right. And so asking yourself, like, what is it that I feel I have capacity for? And then how do I need to go about implementing it? Sometimes it's formal conversations. I need to tell some person, say like, hey, I just need you to know, like, if we go down this road conversationally, I'm probably not going to be able to handle that. And so I'm going to get silent, and I'm just not going to participate, or I'm going to ask if we can pause, or I might, you know, say I need to take a rain check on this conversation and walk away, or whatever it is. Sometimes we need to have those conversations, and other times we need to just do it. Like, we need to just implement the boundary without having to make a big show of it, because we also have to take into consideration, we're having boundaries with people that may not be used to us having boundaries and may not be able to handle our boundaries.
100%.
They don't necessarily need to know that this is a boundary in order for you to implement it. And so there's many times where, like, I have people that I implement boundaries with that they have no idea.
Yes.
It's just, they hear from me when they hear from me, right? They don't know that it takes me behind the scenes going, okay, don't answer. It's okay, right? But that's on me to do that. And they just get a response when they get a response, or they get more dialogue out of me because we're talking about this topic over here and not these other topics over there. So I think the boundaries piece is huge, because that is what protects you as the person. It's not up to the other people to keep that for you, though their respect or lack of respect might give us some information about the relationship, but it is for you. And that is helpful in situations where it doesn't feel like we have a lot that we can control. We can control that. And that can give some stability.
I'm curious, for folks who've come out of high control religion, whether it's recently or long term, we were taught so much to override our feelings and our experience, our intuition, every part of being in a human body. And it occurs to me that because of that endurance, like, we might not even know what it means to feel safe, and what that actually, the experience of feeling safe is, and or that it is allowed or possible. I am curious if you have some tips about, like, what can people do to, in a more neutral moment, find what it feels like to feel safe in your body, when that might not be a thing that you're used to doing, or that even feeling your body might feel scary
in the first place, because, you know, we've been taught so much to be alienated by our religion and also by our culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want to start off by saying this usually takes a while to develop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're listening to this on Saturday and you're like, I'm going to go for internal safety by Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's okay if you don't, because it's going to take some time, because you're right. When we don't have that as our background or as something that we ever had access to, we outsourced all of our coping skills to other things and other people. And so the body, the self, the internal is dangerous and very unfamiliar, right?
Yeah.
So it's like we're learning a new language.
Right.
So it does take a lot of time. But especially for people that are coming out of high control religion, where that's just what is celebrated is the externalized locus of control and externalized coping, we're having to teach something that's never been taught before. And so we have to create something that feels enough like safety that we can use it kind of like as an anchor. And so usually what I'll do with somebody is it's a little bit of some imagery work where I will have them imagine like their favorite place on earth. And it doesn't even have to be a real place. It doesn't have to be somewhere where they've gone before. But we'll just use a beach because that's easy. Most people like beaches. And I'll have them tune in with their senses to that imagery. So what are they seeing? What are the colors and the shapes? How is the light hitting? What are they smelling? What are the noises that they're hearing? Can we tune into them? You know, what are the things that they can touch? Is there any taste, you know, available to them? And we have them get into that spot, and then I'll have them check in with their body to say, what do you notice in your body? Can you maybe take a deeper breath? Or do you feel like, oh, that shaking of the leg has stopped a little bit? Or I feel a little bit like I'm able to put my shoulders down because I'm not so tense. And we just notice some of those physiological cues, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. And then I usually help them recognize, like, you did that in yourself. Like, you weren't actually at the beach. You weren't actually hearing the waves. But you got your body to this place by imagining as if you were in that place. And then we saw this physiological shift, right? And we're felt. We felt the physiological shift. And so usually people are like, okay, A, that's cool. But B, what the hell? Like, I don't know. Like, am I allowed to do this? You know, this kind of feels scary. And sometimes they can't stay there for very long.
Right.
That's okay. Like, the goal isn't to stay there forever anyways. But sometimes it's like, you know what? We need to tap into that for 10 seconds. And then we need to come back up into the present moment, you know, talk about reality TV, whatever it is, just to get a taste of that. And so it's like we build that capacity. Like if we're lifting weights, we start small and we slowly build, you know, the weights and the muscle, right? And we do the same thing when we're talking about internalized safety, is that we might only be able to stay in that spot for 10 seconds, but maybe we do the exercise again and we can stay there for 15 seconds. So we're building that capacity and we're finding different things than in our body where I go, okay, beach. And all of a sudden my body is like, okay, I'm at the beach. And we notice then, how does that shift the way that you're viewing situations? How does that shift the way that you're communicating? How does that shift the way that you're relating to other people or to yourself, how you're interpreting a situation? And it does change everything, because you think about times where you felt safe, you know, whatever that is, very elusive. And you go, yeah, I've been pretty chill. Like, I don't get anxious. I, you know, I'm able to say what I want, or I can take it or leave it, you know, or time versus times that I'm really, really anxious or I'm really scared. And it feels like there's desperation, panic, things like that. So we have to build this as a skill from the ground up for most people. Because they've never experienced it and for sure haven't experienced it on a consistent or ongoing basis, which is what we would hope that most children would be able to experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And interestingly, in the course, I mean, that is where we start. Like that module, like technically it would be month one, module two. That's where we go, because then everything else builds on top of that.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I love
that.
And I think it is just like any other practice, it is practice. And so coming into it with the beginner's mind and continuing to know that there will be times where you're just getting used to it and you're just inching into it, and eventually it will become easier. And then even then, there will be other times where
you might need to deepen that practice or spend more time mm-hmm. training with it, yeah. Just depending on what's going on in your life and kind of what your mm-hmm. needs are. And that can ebb and flow. But I love that. I think that visualization and the bodily sensations that we have mm-hmm. where we see where kind of our mind's eye can take us are such mm-hmm. a powerful way for us to step back into our own power.
Yeah.
In a really beautiful way.
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health, their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
When we talk about like the boundaries piece too, you know, obviously internalized safety is helpful, but we might think so many times it's like answering yes or no to something. That's how, I know if there's a boundary that needs to be set. And so I usually start with more neutral things or things that are relatively pleasant or obviously negative, but not like with a charge behind them. Mm-hmm. So it's like, hey, I just like walked through the mud. Would you lick my feet off? And probably they'll say no. And that sounded weird. They'll lick my feet off, like the dirt, like the mud off my feet.
I mean, right? You can and be into whatever you want to be
sure.
into.
Yes. And this is not kink shaming at all. Okay?
Exactly.
No. But most Never. Of the time they're going, oh, no. Right. Okay. Why would I do that? Right. So it's an easy no. Right.
I love this because I think when we were kids, we didn't get to practice this with easy,
right.
simple things.
We didn't get to say no at all.
Yes. Yeah. We were always being enforced or having reinforced ideas that we did not have autonomy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
this
yeah.
is what you
huge.
Get. Even you don't throw a fit.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Going backwards mm-hmm. to maybe even some of the simple things that we could have been asked mm-hmm. when we were kids.
Yeah.
Might be a way
yeah.
that we can like gently lead yeah. ourselves back into like making this an mm-hmm. easier decision. Because I struggle with this a lot personally. Mm-hmm. I really struggle with the feeling of safety, being in my body and really being mm-hmm. in my body is something that I am still is fairly new to this body mm-hmm. and me. And we've mm-hmm. just met each other like pretty recently, you know, a few times again. And that's been great. Love mm-hmm. her. She's been yeah. through a lot, but I'm a big fan. And I just, yeah, it is a struggle, like as an adult mm-hmm. to do these yeah. things. But I think reminding ourselves, we didn't have this opportunity when we were right. little kids, when we were just mm-hmm. these babies who wanted to explore things and try stuff and, you know, have new experiences. So I love this. And I hope that mm-hmm. Ghosties can do this in ways mm-hmm. you know, yes, it feels like magic, but it doesn't have to if that scares you too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, just being with yourself in a quiet space or being mm-hmm. with yourself out in a beautiful place mm-hmm. that you love and really just being with. And then do some fun things like, would you lick this mud off my feet?
Yeah. Well, and if the answer is no, mm-hmm. what in your body tells you that it's a no, right? It's like, oh, I like reel back and I just want to be like, ugh. Gross, right? And it's like, oh, that there's some signals that are happening in my body that are indicating a no for me. Or if you were to say, let's say your favorite food is ice cream. And I was like, hey, do you want some ice cream? Yes. Okay, well, what tells you that it's a yes? What are the cues in your body that are telling you yes? So I always like to start with neutral or silly or just very non-consequential, kind of non-charged things. Where it would be like absurd, you know, if you were to say the opposite of kind of what's expected, right? You know, and so you're like, okay, I can do that answer in that way. And then I can tune back into my body to say, how did I know that was a no? So then, you know, as we're working on that and we have then a parent comes to us and says, hey, can we have a conversation about X, Y, or Z? Or can you come over for this holiday or whatever? We can already, we're used to tuning in and going, oh, that's, there's a cue for no there. Like I'm reeling back as I have my phone here and I'm, you know, reeling back. Or there's maybe some curiosity there where I'm like, huh, maybe, right? And noticing what all of that is. And that gives us then the ability to then speak or answer from a place that is authentic and from a place that is congruent with what we truly want. Because I think also as women, we are taught to, you know, ignore all of this, say yes, always for the benefit of the other person.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So then if we're answering, if we're practicing that embodied boundaries and we say yes, then we see a congruency there. Mm. Right. Or if we're saying no, it might feel scary, but it's also going to feel congruent. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. I'm curious too. I think there's a lot of that, the enculturated sense of obligation that we feel toward family or others in our lives that we want to support, but we also can't always. And, you know, how do we also support our own selves with our own emotional boundaries around, okay, if I say no, like there will be probably some kind of consequence. You don't know what's going to happen. So like, let's let that be neutral until something happens. And also, let's say your parents invite you for Thanksgiving and you're like, no, like you're, for me, a lot of the time, the like the reaction is more of like even curving inward, like my shoulders kind of coming, you know, and there's this sort of flexation that way that I know for sure is like, and so I think it's also really valuable for us to, on the other side of the decision, to uphold what is good for us. Like, first of all, that's completely fucking fine. And like, it's good for you to feel okay and good.
Yeah. And there's no wrong answer or right answer. It's what is feeling good for me now, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to worry about all the other, quote, consequences or things, but really just hone in on, there is no right or wrong. It's what's okay. It's what's okay for me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And part of being an adult is saying whatever is okay for me, like that still is going to have consequences, good, bad, or otherwise. Right. So it might be a no because that is what's best for me. And I'm going to have to deal with the fallout as a result of that.
Yeah.
Or it might be a yes for me and I'm going to have to take extra good care of myself the days leading up and after. Right.
Right.
There is that. So boundaries can be, they can be easy. Like it could be an easy no. It could be an easy yes. It could be
easy. I was like,
this
feels like a lot of work, you guys.
But it's like, yeah, it's not just that. Yeah, absolutely. And it absolutely can be. And here's the other piece is that when we are able to find safety within ourselves, that is where we can have flexible boundaries as well as really see what's congruent with us. So a lot of times when we are feeling triggered or in danger and we're like, no, right? That may not actually be what the real thing is for us. It might be in that moment because we're really activated. But then I would always invite anybody to go back. And once they feel a sense of calm, once they feel a sense of safety within themselves to say, okay, does that still feel true for me? The way that I responded or what I was thinking then, is there anything that's shifted? Do I need to go back and repair something? Do I need to go back, renegotiate something? And we're allowed to do that too.
I really like that. Well. And I think there's also a lot of value in giving ourselves permission to not answer people immediately. You know, a lot of the time, I think we feel the pressure to on the spot be like, of course, what can I bring or whatever we're inclined to say. And I think it's also just completely fine to also say, oh, let me think about it. And then you can let yourself just, you don't have to think about it a whole bunch, but you can give yourself that space so that you can take the time to get to neutral, to feel in your body and like know what it is for you, and to make that decision thoughtfully and in an embodied way, that then you don't have to put so much pressure on yourself to try to like figure it all out. And I think, like, to your point, Meg, that it does seem like a lot of work, and it sounds like it, because we're breaking down every tiny minutia part of it, partly because this is something to learn how to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it's like actually so much less work to allow ourselves to have the freedom and autonomy to do what is good for us in spite of or without worrying so much about what other people's experience of us will be in that moment. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things I've been learning about and letting myself have is edges. And it's an interesting thing for me to experience, where I'm like, normally I have like autonomy and boundaries and stuff like that, but I also have been very inclined to be as soft as possible, right? And like be gentle and let just pad everything. And there's a point, I think I'm like in my mid 40s and some shit has gone down in my life in the last few years where I'm like, actually, like, it's not my job to caretake everybody else's reactions to me. And how codependent / controlling is it of me to constantly want to do that? And that's partly because that's a way that I've like found safety, right? We do some of these behaviors because it is like it feels safer. But in allowing other people to have their experience, I've learned to trust that the medicine that I need is for me, and whatever that brings for other people is for them. And that's okay. And they need to go take their medicine too. It's not about me necessarily, but it is my job to care for myself so that then everyone around me can care for themselves, and we don't have to be so like deeply enmeshed, or that I don't feel responsible for everyone else's emotional experience all the time and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I like what you said too, Sarai, about giving yourself space and time before responding. And it kind of reminded me of the idea that I don't really like making big plans with large groups of people too far in advance, because I don't know where I'm going to be and how I'm going to feel. And just what I've learned since paying attention to my own body and my own needs is that, sometimes it's a really tough, like when I'm really caring for myself emotionally, but I'm also caring for my family, the people around me, my community. I don't want to open that door wider sometimes. I'm not ready to go out and experience a bunch of other people's opinions or ideas or, you know, like whatever it is, or just their emotional energy that's maybe not in sync with where I'm at. And that's okay too. It's okay to say, yes, I would really love to do that event or that big thing. Let me get back to you when it's closer and I'll see what I can do or whatever. Like, it's okay to take time from especially these big get-together moments with the holidays to not make your solid plans. And I think, you know, the pressure of going, the pressure of booking travel, like all of those things can take a back seat when it comes to, am I okay to go and be in this environment for this amount of time? That's okay. It's not, like you're saying, an obligation of something that we have to do just because we were invited. I'm wondering too, around this election time and holidays, since we're here, what are some things that you're encouraging people to do or that you're doing to kind of give yourself the peace around this election cycle? One of the things I'm trying to do is stay informed without having too much information. Which is a real challenge with the way that our society works right now. But what are some ways that you're finding that are working for you or for people that you've worked with?
Information control from coming from yourself, like being able to say, hey, I've got to turn the TV off. I've got to stop scrolling or whatever. I think that is huge. I really do not believe that our nervous systems are created to consume this much information all the time, and especially this level of crisis and chaos. And then to have to form opinions and then tell everybody your opinion and then deal with the backlash of everybody's disagreement with your opinion. Like, that is not a state of calm and safety for anybody.
Go see this again, because this is, I think, a really important point. That we're not supposed
supposed to be knowing mm-hmm. about so many different people's traumas, things that are going on across the world. Yes, we have empathy, and yes, mm-hmm. we want that to change. And I think all three of us have very strong opinions about things that could be different in our world. Mm-hmm. But it is a lot. It is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for us to stop for a moment and realize even just the things that I personally have experienced in the last year or two for whatever. And then you magnify that by all of the people on the planet. It mm-hmm. is too much. We need to remember that. It is not on us to go into our prayer closets and pray for every single person suffering to end. Like, we don't have to suffer because there mm-hmm. is suffering anymore. We don't have mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to hear that again. Just remember
and there's
that.
There's a whole bunch of like religious messaging that goes into that too. That's very much a savior complex. Mm-hmm. That's an apologetics complex. Like mm-hmm. it's all these things.
Evangelism.
When it's like, I've got to go save the world through my social media posts. Yes. And, you know, everything has to be at a level 10 importance.
Mm-hmm.
Our nervous systems are not, they're just not created for that. They never will get to that point either.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how many ways to find internal safety or practice boundaries, like we're not looking for that capacity to increase necessarily, like so that we can take in all the information all the time.
Yeah.
That will burn us out. That will literally kill us.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I think that, again, this is going to come back to like paying attention to your body, but, you know, paying attention to how your body is responding to certain things, whether it's certain topics or certain people or certain messages or certain lengths of time. Like, I know if I'm super stressed and I'm on my phone, I will start to get physically nauseous at some point. And that's my body going, we're done. We are absolutely done. And I'm like, okay. And I've learned now to listen rather than to push through. But, you know, everything from like, maybe you need to get some app blockers. I have this great app blocker and it turns my apps off. Like, you can't even press them, you know, to like get into social media at 9 o'clock every night. It is my favorite time of day. And I can't see anything from 9 p.m. to 8 a.m. It's the best.
That is the best. I love that.
I breathe like a sigh of relief every 9:01. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, only the people that are like my people can reach me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's great.
I love
it's
that.
Absolutely great.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I personally am an advocate for using social media in whatever way is good for you, like feels good for you. And for me, I stepped away from it entirely in 2020 at the beginning of the year when the COVID nonsense started picking up. And I was working in houselessness in the area in a really visible job. And of course, it was like a really tough time for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I just can't manage this and my whole life, you know? And so I just went away. And it's actually funny because I've never been able to come back. Like, I left for 2 full years all the way. And then I opened it up one time and was like, why am I here? Like, it's not fun anymore. And I think part of it is also like, for me, there are times where I'm in relationship more publicly with people in the community. And there are times when I'm more cocooned or like in sort of a underworld journey or hibernation or something. And so there's also something too, that whole idea of what is a normal network for a human being to be connected with and how many people do you know at a time, and that number being somewhere like 150 or whatever that is. I think to me, another big part is like letting go of my 1500 friends on whatever thing and followers and honestly, like just not messing with needing to know how the algorithms are working and how do I leak things. And it felt risky because I am an entrepreneur, and like some of the messaging has always been like, you have to be on social media, you have to post this many times, you have to do whatever. And it's like, actually, like everybody just secretly, you don't have to do anything. You can do things all kinds of different ways. People have been doing business since forever. And social media was just invented in like the last 20 years. So I think we can all kind of calm down about that. But I found that to be a great protection to my own peace and my just like the spaciousness I have in my mind and my time is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, you know, earlier we talked about how, you know, with Christian nationalism, this is not something that just popped up, right? It's been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. But the difference is when we were growing up, we didn't have the internet. We had newspapers, we had magazines, and we had the evening news. Mm-hmm. And yes,
and Christian radio.
And Christian radio. But we talked about it in our families and in our churches, in our communities. Mm-hmm. Kind of knew what the people out there thought, but we also weren't being required to necessarily take this opinion or you lose your entire community or there's major consequences to pay. And so I think that there's something there is. And obviously, I want to recognize that, you know, access to the internet and social media, there are benefits to that because we're made aware. Our world does become bigger in some really beautiful ways as well. But I think it's okay to say, like, hey, I don't have to have an opinion on everything.
Yes.
And if I do have an opinion, I don't have to share it with anybody that I don't want to, or I don't have to defend myself if I don't want to. I think that's one of the things that I struggle with the most is there's many people that will come to me and demand that I take a side on an issue or that I have to publicly punish somebody or make a statement, which I've just made a habit that I will never do that. And I never have. Mm-hmm. And for me, it saves me so much mental time and energy. And I know that part of that boundary, the quote unquote consequence, is that I have people now that will be like, well, you're not a safe person because you won't say this or that or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? Every single person in my life who knows me, who I care about and who I love, they know exactly where I stand on the issue.
Yeah.
And also, if you don't know where I stand on certain issues based off of my social media, like that's super on you.
And also, okay for me to not be everybody's safe person.
Yeah.
You know, like I might not be safe for every person. I'm probably not safe for somebody who's like, I'm evangelical and I want to stay that way. And I'm going to stay that way by not being in relationship with Sarai Johnson. Like, that's fair, but I get that, you know?
I am not for everybody.
Yeah, and I think that's also, that's a part of it, too, is, like, allowing ourselves to have that division of, like, well, here's my edge, and I don't want to, I'm not going to just put stuff on my social media so that certain people think I'm doing the right thing or that I'm on the right side of whatever issue. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, that is not where reality is. Like, that's not where I'm doing the work. It feels like I'm doing work because I'm posting something or I'm reading a bunch of things, but it's not actually moving the needle on almost anything because I'm not doing any activism. I'm not doing any legislative advocacy. I'm not like changing myself necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm just engaging in this morass. And again, like I said, for me, that was a choice I made. I feel like it was a good choice. For me, and I also engage in different ways at different times, and I think that's fine, too. And everyone should.
Yeah.
But I think having that awareness in yourself and, like you're saying, like the nausea that will come from, like, being overly engaged and on the phone and all that kind of stuff, I think is really important. I'm really interested to, like, just to kind of bring this to the next phase. Like, the election is going to be over in a few days. You know, from the time we're recording this podcast and posting this podcast, and maybe by the time people listen to it, it will have passed. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, can't tell what the outcome is going to be or what the fallout is going to be. But we know there's a lot of rage out there right now. There's a lot of stuff that's scary. There's definitely going to be some consequence and blowback from relationships that we have with people we care about. Even within the evangelical community, I'm starting to see more evangelicals finally, thank you, my God, coming out against Trump and just being like, actually, he's not like Jesus, I just realized. Like, oh, okay, cool. So thank you for doing your religion better, those of you who are in that camp. But still, there is going to be grief. And I think it's really amazing that that's a part of your course around this. And I'd love to hear kind of what you can give us as a, like, how do we buoy ourselves? How do we go through those experiences of loss or of challenge or of, like, just enduring whatever it is that happens as a result of, you know, the ballots?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we think about grief and, like, the quote unquote process of grief, you know, people will say, oh, you know, there's the five steps and whatever. And I actually don't agree with that. Yeah. And I don't think that's what the stages of grief were made for either.
Really cute that we like to do it that way, though.
Give me a list, right?
Yeah, there's some validity in the steps. And one of the things I really do love about when we look at the stages of grief and why Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came up with them in the first place, she came up with them for patients that were chronically ill, mm-hmm. of how do I learn to live while I'm simultaneously dying?
Yeah. Mm.
And I think that there's something about that that we can also take. Mm-hmm. So how do I learn to navigate this while everything is falling apart?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like that piece is really, really important. And so in that, it's like holding these multiple realities that the heaviness is present and it is real and we don't have to ignore it. And I also must keep taking steps forward, mm-hmm. right? We have to balance. We have to learn how to take care of ourselves. We need to validate that, yes, I am feeling this way and I might need to take some time off, or I might need to take some time away from people, or I might need to get really involved, or, you know, whatever it is. And I need to also keep what at least one foot grounded in reality of what is the mm-hmm. next thing I need to do. And when we look at acceptance in the grief process, which is typically the end, but grief is very circular mm-hmm. anyways, it's not this idea that I have to believe that everything's okay. It's actually just going, it is what it is. I can always wish that it was different. I can always wish that it would get better. I can always wish that it would change. And I'm going to be planted in reality mm-hmm. to say, what is happening now? What do I need? What do I feel? Can I let myself be in that and then and move on to the next moment, whatever that brings? And so I think there's just with that is allowing yourself the permission to be accurate and honest about everything that's happening, to whether that's the way that you're feeling, whether it's the way that people have shifted, whether that's the way that we have to like take a really hard look at certain aspects of our life as a result of who wins or who doesn't win, or, you know, people that voted one way or the other way or whatever. Like that's all part of it. And I think part of the reason that grief feels really natural is that we've been going full force ahead. I mean, really since like 2016.
Yeah.
But, you know, this last year, especially in an election year, we're constantly being in shock by this person said what, and this person did what, and they agree with them, and like what, right? And we don't have time to let it absorb and work its way through us, like metabolize, mm-hmm. right? And so I think then when we get to November 6th, but probably like 7th or 8th or 9th or 10th,
yeah.
you know, like whenever we're like finding the results and there's maybe a little bit more certainty one way or the other, I think that's where the grief tends to then start to land and sink in a little bit, because we're now dealing with the reality. Mm-hmm. We're now dealing with this is what it is, and we have to figure out a way to carry on regardless of what the results are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's going to be a wild ride either way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
This has been such a helpful and personally for me, meaningful conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just is good to remind ourselves that it's okay for us to create spaces of mm-hmm. solitude where we can ground ourselves, find our peace, and grieve. And I think the value to knowing that whatever emotion that we're experiencing, it's okay. And we don't have to say yes to everything. We don't have to be concerned about other people's experiences. I mean, don't be mean to people. I mean, take some time for you, but still be your kind self.
I mean, it's all trusting other people, right? It's like, oh, I trust this person to figure it out. Because they will. Everyone does. We all figure it out one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you need some yeah. more supports, we've had Dr. Laura on the podcast a few times. Every single time I've learned something, I've gained knowledge, I've been able to solidify for myself what a boundary is and how to make one and how to keep it and that it's for me and it's not for anybody else. You can go check out our episode, No Mom, That's Not How Boundaries Work, and other fun tips with Dr. Laura Anderson to survive the holidays with your family. Please follow her on Instagram. It's Dr. Laura E. Anderson, and Anderson is S-O-N. So go follow mm-hmm. her. You can also find her on the internet. She's mm-hmm. at drlauraeanderson.com. And please, if you are wanting more supports immediately right now, go check out her course, Religious Trauma in the Elections. It's available now. It's been available You can get it after the elections. It's an instant course, so you get access to everything that has been posted previously. And like she said, she is running it through February. So there will be supports after the election, during the holidays, to Inauguration Day and beyond that. We appreciate you so much, Laura. Do you have any last words of wisdom for us to take with us before we venture on our own?
Thank you. Yeah, it's been great to be here. I add one thing, and it has to do with grief and boundaries and all the things we've talked about, is like there's this concept in somatic work that we use called glimmers. And it's this idea of like finding the moments of lightness and ease. And I think that's really important in a time like this. And that's not bypassing things. It's not ignoring. But it's this idea of like, yeah, the deep, dark stuff very much exists. And we're going to live in it. We're going to go through it and everything. But we also have to find moments of lightness and ease to give our nervous systems a different experience, to remind us that we're here in the present moment, and helps us move on to the next moment. And so that might be that you start rewatching Friends again, or it might be that you, I don't know, have like fun conversations with a gal pal or something, whatever it is. Or it could just be that you let yourself, you know, have an actual 5-minute break outside or something like that. Yeah. But I think that's really, really important. We have to have those moments of lightness and ease, and to look for them in our day, so that we can go back into the rest of our day, which may be a little bit darker and heavier and more intense.
Yeah.
So I think that feels really important in a time like this.
I love that. Yeah, I think prioritizing pleasure needs to become one of our most important things that we do, especially when we're engaging in a world that does feel so sludgy and difficult and dark right now. And so thanks for bringing that up. I love glimmers. That's nice. That's a lovely way to think of it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's awesome. I'm not allowed 2 questions.
Yes.
Okay.
Laura, so do you have any last words of wisdom for us to take with us before we venture on our own? Ghosties, we really appreciate you being here this week and every other week. If you miss us between shows, you can catch us on TikTok, posting almost every day. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, where you can watch this episode as a video. You can find us on TikTok at Holy Ghosting and everywhere else at Holy Ghosting Pod. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time, ghosties. Bye.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.